Ms. Ostapenko has no challenges remaining.
Welcome to No Challenges Remaining. I'm Ben Rothenberg, joined by Tumani Karyal. Hello, Tumani.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. So this episode, to pull back the curtain a bit, is going to be mostly be part that we recorded about a week ago after Miami that deals with the Premier Tour and things like that. But there's been a couple breaking news developments that we want to get to and update you on before getting to that meat of the show, and we'll take out things that are outdated from what we've talked about previously. But in the main part of the show, we talk about Premier Tour ideas, which, Tumani, you just wrote a column about for The Guardian that came out today. Yep. So that's good timing, actually, for that. And then also about the demise of the Breakpoint Netflix show we also talked about for quite a bit during this episode. So we'll get to that. There's two, though, breaking news developments that I want to cover first. There's a small one and a big one. You could argue which is which, but I think that the small one, by most of those definitions, would be the news report by NCR, friend of NCR, past guest of NCR, Laura Robson, who said that there is a scene in the upcoming Challengers movie featuring Zendaya and Michael Feist and Josh O'Connor, I think is his name. In the Challengers movie, there is a scene that takes place at the Cincinnati tournament, and then they all go and eat at whoever, it's some collection of people go and eat at Applebee's afterwards, which is the kind of authenticity that makes me, honestly, genuinely much more excited for this movie now. And you as well, Tumani?
Yeah, me too. I'm as we're speaking, I'm going to see it tomorrow at the premiere, and I'm ready now. I'm ready. In the last podcast, I was critical of the actual tennis being played in the adverts in the trailer.
Nah, come on, yeah.
With as you say, as with Rihanna in the background, but now I'm ready for it. Now I'm excited to see what nuggets there are for like the very small, you know, group of tennis fans who, you know, would recognize Applebee's and make the connection to the real Cincinnati tournament. It's not a lot of people, but...
No, yeah. I'm excited because, for me, it means that Luca Guadagnino, I think, wrote the screenplay. He's certainly the director. He's the director behind this movie. I think he's a screenwriter also, but either he or someone in his close circle listens to NCR, A, or B, at least for the New York Times article I wrote about the Madison, Ohio Applebee's experience. And so one of those two things happened. Either one of them is fun. As I say, at the end of this episode, the next episode we'll do probably will be me and Andrew Eccles talking about the movie. And Tumani, if you want to join too, by all means, we'd love to have you. We'll see how that all goes and what we think of this movie and how it compares to Breakpoint in different ways. Okay, so that's the small news, technically. It's an Applebee's there as a milieu for the Challengers movie. The bigger, more recent news development, I think most people would agree, is that not only did players used to eat at Applebee's, but now they will be eating at whatever dining establishments there are in Riyadh come the fall, for the next couple of falls, as the WTA has announced that the WTA Finals, their year-end championships event, is going to be doing a three-year residency in the capital of Saudi Arabia, Riyadh. This is not a surprise. This has been sort of an open secret, I think, in the sport. This was going to get announced soon. This was on track. It was actually, a lot of people thought it would happen for last year, and it was a surprise when it pivoted away from that towards what eventually wound up being Cancun as the host last year. Tennis reporter John Wertheim reported that the announcement had actually been delayed to wait until after Indian Wells in Miami, so as not to overshadow those big 1,000 events and to create too much sort of scrutiny on players there. So it happened during Charleston, which, by the way, sequel to our last episode, Danielle Collins won and continued her amazing run, having won these two big tournaments back-to-back without a bye in either and with really dominant form throughout. So shout-out to Danielle Collins, but who is actually in contention now for this year-end championships event in Saudi Arabia. So, Tumani, you wrote about this a bit today, although it was more about the Premier Tour, but I want to start with you. Like, what do you make of this news, which would have seemed, I think, really unthinkable, let's say 5 years ago, but now has seemed inevitable for nearly a year?
Yeah. First of all, it's been interesting just to see how it's kind of this slow burn of, you know, Saudi Arabia's growing influence in tennis has, mm-hmm. you know, gradually increased, starting from just basic exhibitions earlier, you know, a few years ago, then a few bigger exhibitions, then the next gen ATP finals, the Rafa Nadal and his now being an ambassador for Saudi Tennis Federation,
yeah.
and earning many, many millions as well. and now this. And so in that way, I feel like you've seen Saudi Tennis Federation and PIF and all of those, you know, Saudi government organizations probably like adapting from other sports, you know, when they came in all guns blazing and generated a lot of attention for, you know, whether it was with golf, with you know, PGA and LIV and with football. So in that sense, we're reacting here and it's not really a surprise. It's not shocking. It's been coming. But I still think, I mean, on the whole, it's obviously very, I think, disappointing coming from the WTA, a sport that has been built on equality, on women's rights, and going to a country where clearly there are both women and LGBTQ people are, you know, actively being oppressed and all the issues that have been discussed. I think it was particularly it hit home for me seeing the WTA release a statement confirming that gay players, you know, that if they qualify for the WTA finals, if they're part of the, you know, the top eight in singles or doubles, that discussed with the Saudi organizers, and that they would be allowed to, you know, enter the country and be, you know, stay in hotel room with their spouses. The fact that that has to be confirmed, and the fact that, you know, that's something that has to be discussed is, I think, pretty quite shocking and just galling, and it just raises red flags. And yeah, I guess that's my first thought. How about you?
I wasn't surprised. I think it's good you mentioned LIV, which started what year? Probably like 2022, 2021. So relatively recently, LIV Golf, which was this really contentious arrival of this rival tour to challenge the men's tour in high elite level golf, the PGA Tour. And that was with the backing of Saudi Arabia and some other sort of mavericks, let's say, within the golf establishment, Greg Norman. And that was really disruptive and really antagonistic for the sport of golf, for men's golf. It really dominated things. And I feel like ever since that really sort of almost like hostile takeover kind of vibe that infusion of Saudi interest into pro sports had there, everything subsequent has been much smoother and much less adversarial and much more accepting and consensual and collaborative, whatever you want to call it. Certainly you mentioned the soccer players, big players like Cristiano Ronaldo and Neymar getting deals to play for Saudi clubs, lots of other less famous European and other world players as well playing in Saudi Arabia, some of them leaving actually since then, but those have been going there. Leonardo Messi is an ambassador for the Saudi soccer situation also, including their World Cup bid, which is interesting because I think it's competing. They might be outdated, but last I heard, he's still supporting the Saudi bid, even though it's competing against an Argentina bid in the next cycle of bidding for World Cup hosting. And then the men's tour has gone there as well. All those events that I've mentioned previously, those are all men's sports. And so I think there's seen as this different sort of breakthrough, for better or for worse, if you want to call it, whatever you want to call it. But it is a breakthrough, having this be a major women's sports organization saddling up with the Saudis in this way. And part of me, you know, I sort of, just for the sake of the conversation, I'm going to play devil's advocate some of these things. But why should the women not get to access this huge money that all these men have? You know, why should it be beholden on them as businesses to have to turn down these enormous sums of cash? And they are big amounts of cash. I mean, they're currently on pace to exceed the men's prize money at the year-end championships by a bit, which, you know, means the men are going to tick theirs up to move right past it. That's what happened last time. Last time the women leapfrogged the men came back with a new deal to make sure they were just a nose ahead of the women, because they couldn't stand being behind the women. You know, and hopefully, so the prize money of 14 something million for this event, it's back to 15. Around the same 15, right? About the same as it was for the Shenzhen deal, which obviously we know blew up. And that Shenzhen deal thing is still instructive for understanding everything that's happened since in women's tennis. And so that is one thing that is going on, them getting that deal. And also, I hope, and we also don't know what other cash is there in the deal, you know, sorts of other things that could help fund the tour beyond just the prize money purses. You'd hope there's a lot of cash. And I hope that the Women's Tennis Association was not cheap. I almost wish, on some level, this has been an even bigger announcement that, like, the Saudis are coming and they're going to equalize all prize money at every tournament around the calendar. Because that's the kind of money we know Saudi Arabia has.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually, to take it back a second, following on from your devil's advocate argument, obviously the argument that the WTA would probably put forward privately is that they just don't have much money. Their funds have been decimated since COVID, and with everything that happened with, you know, the initial Shenzhen deal, Shenzhen stepping, basically breaking the agreement after COVID, after Peng Shuai, and so having this offer, probably from their perspective, they'd argue is a no-brainer, I think. But yeah, on the subject of the money, I actually, that was kind of one of my first reactions was that, you know, I saw like a tweet from BBC, you know, on Twitter about it, and they're like head explosion emoji, like huge prize money, blah blah blah, and it's not actually that much considering it's comparing to the Shenzhen deal. The Shenzhen deal was
only $1 million more. Yeah,
this is $15.25 million, adjusting for the massive amount of inflation that has happened in the last since 2019. It's less than Shenzhen, and as you said, there's been just some of the figures that they've thrown, that Saudi Arabia has thrown around at different sports, that's not that much. And
they spent $500 million recently on just the one golfer, John Rahm.
Yeah. So
one golfer.
Yeah.
Not Tiger Woods. One guy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. From that perspective, I was also kind of not that impressed that they weren't able to get more for such a significant move that would obviously garner a lot of criticism.
And we don't know all the details. Like I said, I don't know. Yeah. All we see is the front-facing number from the prize money purse announcement. But hopefully, like I said, I thought there was, and I said this last, or in February, March, whenever it was, I did this podcast, when they first announced, this was with Alex Gruskin on Cracked Rackets, when they first announced the PIF deal to sponsor the rankings, which went up, as we later saw, including the ATP rankings, which later included a bunch of ads over the backboards of the courts in Indian Wells and Miami. PIF logos were very prominently branded there, you know, saying like if the Saudis want to come in, like it should be really game breaking amounts of money. It should, if including, like I said, I think it'd be the kind of ultimate play for Saudi Arabia to say, we are making women's tennis finally equal. Like, look at us making all the prize money equal, closing the pay gap entirely, committing to keep it closed for the next 50 years, whatever kind of thing they wanted to pledge, make it so like you couldn't deny that Saudi Arabia was elevating women in this way. Like it made it like, and maybe they didn't want to do that. Maybe that's overpaying what I think the value of women's tennis is right now, but the symbolic value of that, to the extent that it's an interesting situation where I think the Saudis, you know, you have to look obviously what they're getting out of it too. They're getting this, the women get the money and the Saudis get the clout of getting one of the biggest women's sporting organizations in the world to endorse them and to partner with them and to say, we are with them. We think this is something we can do. Like you said before, I think one of the other things that when you talk about the WTA not having money, one of the most important things I bring up when I've done interviews about this, I did a bunch when the news broke a few days ago on various different like BBC or Australian media, whatever I was doing, was there weren't better offers. That's the thing. Like this was the best offer at a time when women's tennis is not dealing from a position of strength. There's not a robust number of stars. You're not selling a finals that potentially has players like, you know, Serena and Sharapova going, and Venus, and you know whoever else you want to say in there, and recent stars Osaka even likely to play. You're going with a cast of top eight players who is likely to not be the biggest names, and who aren't from countries largely that are traditional tennis markets, with the exception of probably Coco Gauff is one of the leading stars, currently number 3 or 4 in the rankings, and she's from the U.S. But that hasn't been enough to make the U.S. bidding for this event so far. And you know, people talk about Świątek. Poland did not step up with a bigger offer than Saudi Arabia did. Like, you know, this is what they got. This is what they had on the table. And it's tough to say that they can't do, if the players want to go, and the players have really not pushed back with this. One of the main questions, you know, people ask is, what do the players think of this? Externally, there's been no objection from current players. Internally, as far as I've heard, it's been minimal, with the exception of, you want to talk about Kasatkina?
Yeah, that's all. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kasatkina did say that she's not comfortable with it. And obviously it's unfortunate that she gets branded as like the token, you know, gay lesbian player in this movement, because she's not the only one. certainly on tour. She's the most publicly out. She travels the tour with her girlfriend, Natalia Zabaiko, and they do their vlog and everything. And she did express hesitation, certainly. It wasn't thrilled about this. And she might be on track to qualify this year. She's going to be in the mix for sure to qualify this year with her results this year. So she'll be in contention for one of these spots. There's also at least one doubles player I can think of who I think is out, who's probably in qualifying contention right now for this tournament, who would also be there. So there's, you know, there's that's the concern too. And the other thing I would say on that is that it's not just about these players. It's also about WTA staff and organizers and officials and people who may belong to any number of groups who wouldn't feel comfortable there. And that is potentially very tough for them. And we'll see, you know, if there is a different group of officials or organizers who they have to bring in because they're normal sort of core people, because there's a lot of diversity on those fronts, on both tennis tours, actually, and especially WTA. WTA has this history of being founded by lesbians, frankly, and it's in their DNA as an organization. And so that could be something to think about and to hesitate, to pause over for sure, in a way that I think it's not just about Daria Kasatkina. I think it's about this bigger issue. And that goes for also like fans who might want to go to the year-end championships for the women too, who wouldn't consider it because of where it is, or media who might want to cover it for their jobs who wouldn't go because of where it is, and all these other various stakeholders and participants in this event who will be made to feel unwelcome in certain ways. I almost feel like the sort of what they said about what you mentioned, the accommodations for accommodations with the players being allowed to stay with their same-sex partners in Saudi Arabia, that's almost like the more aggressively scrubbing sports washing. Like, yeah. It's fine if someone brings their girlfriend to Saudi Arabia, some woman brings her girlfriend to Saudi Arabia. Like, is it? Like, no, you're making a very special exception to this, because as much as women are making progress in Saudi Arabia, I don't think the LGBT movement has any progress or traction or future there. I think these things are still just as illegal and as prosecuted there as they will be, and I don't see much sign of progress on that front. So I think actually for me, the bigger objections to Saudi Arabia are more the LGBT stuff than the women's stuff. I think women, they seem to be making progress and moves, and the LGBT, no.
Yeah, in some ways, but we'll see how, I mean, in both sides, we'll see how far the kingdom is willing to, you know, continue to, even with women's rights, continue to evolve. We'll see about that. Just going back to things you said before, I think in an imaginary world where WTA hadn't and Shenzhen hadn't split and they'd, you know, continued and seen out the deal before moving to Saudi Arabia, they probably would have been maybe in a better position to argue for more. But obviously, we've also seen in the past couple of years how the WTA finals has gone, they've gone to, you know, Guadalajara, Dallas-Fort Worth, and then obviously the mess in Cancun. I'm sure after how things went down in Cancun, the Saudi officials might have been feeling good about, you know, the arguments they make about, you know, prize money and the negotiations, since, yeah, as you said, they were not coming from a position of strength. I still think also this is just an interesting choice given what happened with Shenzhen. This is obviously not the first contentious decision that WTA has made in terms of its WTA final, in the decision to host the WTA finals in certain countries. I mean, it was in Doha in 08 to,
yeah, 2010. I was mentioned Doha, yeah.
And then obviously in Shenzhen, that was, I mean, we discussed it at length, particularly, and it was particularly galling when just before the event was supposed to be hosted in that very stadium, they were doing military drills that were pointed towards
Hong Kong,
the unrest in Hong Kong and the protests there, which is very close to Shenzhen. And we saw how after, obviously these were exceptional issues, just that, you know, they don't happen every day. A pandemic doesn't happen every day, and nor does what happened with Peng Shuai and how the WTA was unable to, well, still has been unable to directly contact her since she publicly spoke about her relationship with Zhang Guoli, former Chinese vice premier, and accusations of sexual assault, sexual coercion, certainly. And yeah, we've seen what happens when these events take place, and in the end, Shenzhen split with the WTA. And so they've gone straight into another contract with an authoritarian government. We'll see what happens. Maybe the three years will run smoothly, or maybe there could be another incident, and then and in that position, they have no power. And we saw, thinking about a couple of years ago when in the F1, and 2 years ago, there was a missile attack a few miles away from the F1 track. And from the reporting, it seemed like a lot of the F1 drivers wanted to leave. And after it happened, they were shaken up and, you know, afraid that, you know, they could be in peril. And they were basically, and it seems like, just from the reporting, that they were kind of informed that there might be difficulties with them even leaving the country if they decided not to race. And so in the end, they were kind of forced to race and to complete it. So, yeah.
This is what I think your point has been about the Shenzhen situation too, is that these things are foreseeable. The idea that there's some, it's not bad luck, right? That something happens with Chinese oppression right after you sign this deal for the tournament. Like, no, this was foreseeable. These sort of habits that these countries are known, and similarly with Saudi Arabia, with a very checkered record on these things, you know, if something along the lines of another Khashoggi incident happens in Saudi Arabia, you know, during the WTA's time there, that will not be an unforeseeable event in certain ways. You could certainly have some sort of civil rights, human rights issue that could pop up to make the tournament or the tour look worse for being partnered and located and based in Saudi Arabia. That said, again, to sort of shift to the other side, one of the other things that I've been interested to hear from women from this region, actually from Arab countries, who I've been interested to, they're not anywhere near as cynical as people from Europe and America are about this thing, about this whole development. Thing which I think it's very easy for us to roll our eyes at, this idea of like, oh, it's great for women in the region, you know, or girls in the region to see this women's event there and have this example and to learn from that and have it inspire them and everything and you know, help women in the region that way. And that's something that I think most of people outside of this region roll their eyes at as propaganda and as hollow, but it does from the, you know, Ange Jabeur probably most notably is, you know, is as a Tunisian is, and the best Arab tennis player, male or female, in history. She says that she believes that she co-signs that idea. She supports that, and other women within Saudi Arabia and beyond who are given the chance to talk about this, I've heard from this group, say similar things. Like they don't always push against that. And so it's not like, again, maybe part of this for me is just that it is so much more normalized. Maybe it is, you know, like I said, this is like the fourth or fifth major sporting development in Saudi Arabia. In terms of big trends, you know, using soccer is just one development. There's been a lot of stuff, and it feels less stark. And maybe that's the sports washing already making it cleaner than it was 3 years ago. But yeah, but it's just interesting to me that it just feels like it's not. I don't know. Like I think it's totally fair for someone to say the WTA was founded, the original nine, all the things on this really profound equality social cause as a cause, right? Not just a business. And there's this duality within women's sports, and who we talked about before on the show. Hopefully we have. The being a cause versus being a business, right? And I think as a business, I think this move makes total sense and is very defensible. This is the most money. You get it there. Your employees, in terms of your star employees and your players, are receptive to it, are not pushing back against it really. And there you go. You get this big money, hopefully more money, again, beyond just the prize money, and it's where you go. The cause side of things, I think, is much tougher to justify. And I do think that remains relevant to women's sports. And it's unfair. It's a double standard that the men don't have to answer to. The ATP is not a cause. ATP is just a business, meaningfully. Whereas WTA has chosen the mantle and, you know, exploits it themselves, too. They do, you know, promotions for themselves and events for themselves to celebrate their history and to try to almost, you know, commoditize or... to brag about their stances for equality and women and all those sorts of things to help the business. It is part of their brand. But yeah, it is also, that's also a lot of pressure. You know, that goes for anybody who's sort of ever staked out any kind of moral high ground for themselves. You know, anyone who's ever, we see that with, you know, betting, like all these people getting betting sponsorships now. If you ever said anything anti-betting or anti-abused players get and took that stand before, then it's harder for you to double back and accept some enormous amount of money that could be out there in the betting world to get So that's a tricky double standard. And I understand the women saying, why are we held to such a higher standard than the men? Because the men have already been in Saudi Arabia since last year and could easily, don't seem to be blocking any sort of possible further developments there in terms of adding a master's event or whatever else it may be. It feels like the kind of moral weight is just freighted onto the women. And yeah. I understand them pushing back at that or balking at that.
Yeah. And this is by no means the final stop in terms of Saudi Arabia.
Nope.
You know, entering tennis. And yeah, as you said, the discussions ongoing about Masters 1000, about money, more money from Saudi Arabia coming into finance tennis. I think you raised a good point about Jabeur actually, and mm-hmm. and the opinions of Arab athletes and female athletes in the region mattering, particularly as obviously with Jabeur, we talk a lot about how she has been a trailblazer and the achievements she's been able to unlock in her career in the context of Arab tennis. So I do think that her opinion on the subject is relevant and important, and as yeah. you say, she's been very effusive and excited about Saudi Arabia coming into women's tennis. And she, and I should note as well that she's also now sponsored by a Saudi Arabian clothing brand,
yeah,
like a lifestyle brand in her tennis wear. Yeah, we'll see what's next, because it, as I said, it feels like there is probably going to be more in this subject and more of the Saudi Arabian presence in tennis. I did find it yeah. quite galling. In addition to the PIF signage on the Miami Open, and the now it seems like most of the men's Masters 1000s event, that just the like sponsored posts. I don't know if you saw any of them on like Twitter from the Miami yeah. Open account.
I think we talked about this a bit in the part we already recorded, but yeah, some of these okay. posts and Sam Querrey doing all this sponsored yeah. influencer videos from Indian Wells. Like, hey, Sam Querrey, let's go take a tour of all the great things PIF is doing at Indian Wells.
Yeah.
It was. Low-key very good at social media, Sam Querrey, and getting a check from PIF there, or hopefully many checks from PIF there. So yeah, so we'll keep you posted, obviously, how it unfolds, how it goes. It's some basic other things, like the actual event itself. Will it suck? I mean, because I think it's a fair question, because the crowd at that next-gen event in Jeddah, which is not a different city than Riyadh, a smaller city than Riyadh, but it was really puny. And especially those opening days, and they finally managed to fill the stands for the final, I think. But those opening sessions were really grim, and just the visuals again, which we had in Fort Worth, certainly they weren't great. But that was much more slapdash in terms of how late they came together. Credit at least to WTA for doing what we wanted them to do in terms of getting a bid finalized and announced months in advance, multiple months in advance, when previously it had always been 3 years in a row, then after U.S. Open. So yeah. at least, you know, marginal improvement, but at least better there. 3-year deal. Not the longest deal they've had. Actually, one of the shorter deals they've had, considering that Shenzhen was a 10-year deal and Singapore was a 5-year deal. This is not the longest deal, for better or for worse. If it's successful, I'm sure it could get extended. But relatively short deal. Yeah, I just worry about what the atmosphere will be in the stands. Will these women feel like they're being... Because that's the thing about, you know, and this is the case certainly in a lot of rounds of tournaments in China as well, where there's all this money and government support and big modern stadiums, but then they're just empty. And it just feels false. It feels inauthentic yeah. somehow. And Saudi Arabia, yeah. I think, certainly is at risk of that with this event.
And you mentioned that it's a good decision, business decision in terms of the, you know, the finances and the amount of money that, both in terms of prize money and all the other money that I'm sure the WTA are receiving.
I hope they are, yeah.
Well, yeah, you'd expect. But I guess there is a question of, yes, in terms of finances, it's a good thing. But in terms of making this, your showpiece event, something that people will want to watch and will watch it and consider it an important event, and that, you know, that and to build its kind of build its legacy and build its just importance.
Yeah.
I also have doubts about that. If you're turning the TV on and there's no one there. But we'll see.
You want it to feel aspirational. You know, you want like the sort of road to insert city name place. It's not like a place you want to go to.
Yeah. Right.
And I don't know that Riyadh has that cachet at this point among players or among the general public. It's not a tourist destination for any normal tourists, really, that I've ever heard of. And so, yeah, that's something to consider there as well. I think Singapore had that. Shenzhen did not have that. You know, you want it to feel something, like something special and cool, both in terms of branding and in terms of the actual experience of being there. And that was the thing that kind of annoyed me. We did the podcast about the Cancun mess, is that part was all what was worse, was sort of the ambiance stuff. The players actually made a good amount of money in Shenzhen, and sorry, in Cancun.
Yeah.
The prize money.
Prize money.
Yeah, the prize money. I think like Iga Świątek made like $3 million winning that tournament and was still complaining about it hugely. And I was sort of like, you know, you made a lot. Like, this was, they preserved the money, and but it still wound up being such a negative net event for them as a product. So the money is not everything. There's a lot of other things that have to be achieved. And the money is almost, I think we said this on the last episode, or a recent episode anyway, but like the prize, equal prize money should not almost be the priority for women's tennis when they have so many other things they can catch up on in terms of making the product better and comparable, as the men kind of pull away from them in a lot of markets, especially again, as we saw with, you know, I don't know if you followed the college basketball, but the
I was just about to mention
the ratings for the women being so much, were so huge and bigger than the men, and just, you know, other women's sports, especially what happened again with Women's March Madness, Caitlin Clark, South Carolina, those are showing the possibilities for women's sports. And WTA, which was so proudly such a leader for so long, falling off the pace is something that myself as a women's tennis fan am concerned and worried by. So I'd like to see that. I'm rooting for women's tennis always, not down on it as in that sort of big cause. I hope that they, yeah, I hope they can do what's right. And I do hope that whatever they got for selling out in this sort of way, that they certainly did compromise some of their values to take this deal. I hope that it was a good price. I hope that it was a great price. I hope it was an enormous price. And I hope that they can reinvest that in themselves in ways that strengthen the brand to where they become able to do it from a position of strength next time they have to come to the bargaining table, next time there is a bidding process to be had.
Time will tell.
Time will tell. Anything else you want to add on any of these things before we pitch it back to... So the rest of the episode, we, as I mentioned at the top, we recorded about the Premier Tour and the sort of big, some of the big changes afoot there, this really radical possible reimagining. Because this is the thing with the Saudi news. And this is basically just inserting a city line name into the calendar, right? It's just saying this rotating event is not rotating here. It's not really a profound shaking logistically of this, culturally maybe, logistically no. It's just this rotating event is rotating to somewhere new. But this Premier Tour stuff is much more profound existential change to the tour. So ready to kick it over to that discussion we had?
Let's kick it.
Let's kick it. Bow. Kicked away. Welcome to No Challenges Remaining. I'm Ben Rothenberg, joined once again by Tumani Carroll. Hello, Tumani.
Hello.
So we are just continuing our chat here on this evening in early April. We're going to talk about one of the big storylines that was brewing during the Sunshine Double, in the shadows of the Sunshine, in the back rooms and the boardrooms, whatever else, which is these competing bids to sort of renovate the sport. These two different plans. One is the sort of ATP / Saudi plan, which is where the Saudis would come in with a $1 billion commitment from the PIF, the public investment fund. They're using, they already have their branding all over the courts of Indian Wells in Miami. It's been striking to see these just PIF logos suddenly everywhere on courts. And again, just like weird, because it's just weird to me that also it's like, it's not explicit too. Like, no one knows what PIF is unless you really know.
Yeah.
But it's everywhere.
Yeah. And also, like, they had all the, I don't know if you saw the Twitter posts with like these random like fans being invited to the suite, the PIF suite. And
I saw the Sam Querrey influencer stuff. Did you see that?
No.
Sam Querrey doing SponCon for them. Oh, Sam Querrey in Indian Wells was like, hey, I'm here with, you know, PIF or PIF, and we're at the PIF tent and this PIF sponsor activation. He was like really selling it. And it's like, okay, this is interesting. And, you know, good for him for making money alongside his pickleball income. But yeah, it was interesting to see like how they're moving into it and how it's like foregrounded, but also opaque. It's like no one's saying this is Saudi Arabia. Like the letters, you know, it's SA, not PIF is what meaningfully is there. Anyways, interesting. That's also interesting in context of Washington tournament, right? For me personally, locally, which has Mubadala as the title sponsor. No one knows that's the UAE's similar thing. Like, it's kind of weird how these countries put this money and stuff and then don't totally foreground that it's them with the money. It's just weird to me. Anyway, so there are these two competing offers that are both trying to revamp tennis radically. One is this $1 billion commitment from Saudi Arabia. This is, I'm quoting from John Wertheim's article. He did an interview on Sports Illustrated with the USDA CEO, and this is kind of him framing it. But basically, the one offer is a $1 billion commitment from Saudi Arabia to bankroll a streamlined ecosystem of tennis, which would probably be merged into tours, I'm guessing. And the hitch would be there'd be a guaranteed 1,000-level event added to the calendar in Saudi Arabia, potentially in January, before the Australian Open. It's in one of the talks, which Tennis Australia, Craig Tiley, pushing against hard, understandably, because they've had that whole month themselves really on the calendar before. The other proposal, so that's one proposal. The other proposal is for a Premier Tour, which is a more radical revamping of things. And this is energy being led by the four Grand Slam federations who are all together on this. And this is quoting from Wertheim, outlining a new professional tennis model, which offers the four majors, 10 other events, which all have 96 player draws, men and women, equal prize money, all held outdoors. A team event of some kind, whether it's United Cup or something else. Year-end finals for both men and women held at the same site. Guaranteed off weeks before and after majors. And a minimum two-month off-season. And a PGA-style tour, which is open to the top 100 players, roughly, with a developmental tour open to the players ranked 101 through 300. And Lou Scherr, the USDA CEO, tells Wertheim, it all starts from a proposition that tennis is an attractive sport, but it underperforms commercially, which is creating challenges to support athletes and for the sustainability of tournaments. I don't think that's news to anybody in the industry, he says. He adds that there are 10 events that are driving 80% of the revenue in our sport. That's not sustainable, he says. We need to get a sustainable model. So they're talking about what would they get and what's sort of left in this Premier Tour, which is a sort of Formula One-based thing. I'm not super familiar with Formula One, but to mine, I'm sure you're more familiar with it. You can explain how that works in a bit. But to me, it's just most striking what we lose in the Premier Tour model, which is a ton of successful and well-liked tournaments. You know, I mean, again, I mentioned Washington, Mubadala, briefly. That would be gone. Washington would be gone. Anything 500 or lower. So we're talking about Berlin, Hamburg, Halle, Barcelona, Tokyo, Brisbane, Queen's Club, Stuttgart, Auckland, Beijing, Doha, Dubai on some level, for the men certainly at least, Basel, Vienna, Rotterdam, Estoril, Charleston, Houston, Acapulco, Rio de Janeiro, Buenos Aires, everything in Latin America would be off the table in this proposal. And it just seems like throwing away a lot of bathwater, or a lot of baby with the bathwater, let's say, to have such a radical change. And is it worth it from business perspective? I don't know. Is it worth it from a fan perspective? I feel fairly confident in saying no. I don't think so. I don't get the sense that fans have really enjoyed this longer. We've had a couple years of this, right? With Madrid being longer, going from 1 week to 2 weeks. Rome also. We're going to get this soon with Canada and Cincinnati also. Cincinnati ends on a Monday this year. It's bizarre. Some weird shifting happening already on the tours. Can you make the case for sort of this Premier Tour, like what they think and what you make of this really radical renovation? Because they're talking about essentially getting rid of the ATP and WTA tours as they exist and getting rid of the rankings potentially as they exist. It would be a hugely disruptive thing for sort of all the records we talk about, you know, for rankings, weeks at number one, Masters events won, sort of, you know, all the sorts of stuff. It just wouldn't be counting. Titles won even be totally different if you couldn't win that many titles anymore. It would really be a hugely disruptive thing for the sport.
Yeah. So to get back to, you mentioned Formula One, and Formula One's obviously been the big sporting success story over the past few years. I mean, clearly tennis tried to copy them with the Netflix docuseries, and that.
We should also talk about that. Yeah, we know about that in here.
Yeah. But Formula One had Drive to Survive, and that really generated a lot of interest, particularly during COVID. That's what I'm actually someone who started watching Formula One during COVID, you know, sitting at home, you know, not being able to go anywhere or do anything. And that just clarified the sport for me and made it more interesting. But in terms of the structure, it's just different big Grand Prix events, an increasing number, actually. There are like 20 plus now, but, you know, it's just these singular events. There's like lower events, there's Formula 2 and things like that, but that's a completely different division, different cars, different everything. And I think that's what tennis is clearly trying to copy. They want what are currently the Masters to be these big standalone events, and that to be the only real attraction, right? that, and they think that's what will simplify the sport for fans and casual fans, and it will make them more interested in it. There are obviously some advantages to this, and I mean, as you've listed, it's more streamlined anyway, so players will, they'll have fewer tournaments, likely have fewer tournaments to play, equal prize money, the tours coming together, and you know, being on, you know, under one roof, things like that, clearly. But I also just share doubts about it. Firstly, as you said, we've seen the ATP and the WTA kind of following along really as they've tried to make, you know, kind of quote premium events, unquote, with these kind of almost attempts at mini slams with the tournaments increasing to 12 days, the 2 week events, and they're just long. And I actually think tennis is quite lucky that, unlike many other sports, in tennis we have four massive events. We have four world championships every year, and they all have this level of importance and gravitas and just reach that very few other major sporting events have. Certainly Wimbledon is bigger than any one Formula One Grand Prix. So
compare it to a sport like any Olympic sport, which basically has a meaningful best on best world championships once every 4 years. Tennis has 16 times that number of frequency of its biggest titles. That's hugely lucky. Yeah. That's already a lot. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
They want more.
But they want more. And I just don't, I'm not sure that's possible. And just seeing like how I was in Madrid and Rome as well. And by the second week, when there are so few matches, it just felt like it was dragging on. It didn't have the level of that importance, that gravitas to sustain it. You know, the one quarterfinal or two quarterfinal matches we were waiting for in a day were not that important compared to a US Open quarterfinal or Wimbledon quarterfinal. And so I'm not sold on that, but you go on. I have more to say.
Well, no, I agree with you. I don't think, logically for me, I don't think it makes sense that getting rid of, let's say, Washington increases the importance of Cincinnati.
No.
Like, I don't really buy that per se. I don't get the sense that, like, this is sort of like chaff that's meaningfully, like, gumming up the works of the sport at this 500 level. I don't think so. I think, if anything, it's sort of, you mentioned in the previous episode, Coco Gauff getting her momentum in Washington and using that to roll onto this great summer. Have that be meaningful for her there, and whatever other, you know, tournaments where it's Sinner, you know, in Beijing last year, I think it was, where he had a really sort of his first kind of, what, that's kind of where his story starts, right? And his other moments to play. And I can't totally tell him this in this proposal from Premier Tour, this is like the only time your top 50 players will get to play is at these 14 events, so they have no other options to add, you know, smaller tournaments on. But if you're kind of struggling, that's not very many tournaments. And most players are playing closer to 20, 21 tournaments a year. And so going down to 14 maximum is a big cut and would lead for much more arrhythmic tennis. Lots of players like playing, you know, losing 1 week and getting right back on the next Monday and getting into another draw and having hope spring eternal every week. You know, eventually you can catch fire 1 week, and that's kind of how it works. And this wouldn't have that. Also for fans too. I mean, we're used to tennis, and this is, again, is this good or bad? I think it can be debated, but we're used to tennis kind of always being on. You know, usually if you're awake at a given time of year, there's probably tennis on somewhere in the world, and you can watch it. Maybe you have to stay up a little bit late if it's the Asian swing, whatever it may be for your given time zone. But this would change it a lot to have there be real dark periods of tennis for roughly half the weeks of the year, give or take, maybe a third of the weeks of the year. I don't know what exactly the math would be on that. But that would change, certainly, from it being kind of ever-present thing to a more selective thing. And yeah, the number of tournaments would go down. Maybe that scarcity, they think, would lift the prestige of a Cincinnati or Canada or Madrid title. Do those titles need to be bigger? I'm not sure, because I still think the Grand Slams will remain the Grand Slams. I still think those tournaments will be considered second tier below Grand Slams, at least. And I don't know what meaningfully getting rid of the other ones does. I also think it's interesting, and I don't disagree with this part as much, but I think it's an interesting pivot or shift. All this talk that's going on in kind of the PTPA chatter and other players, whether it's real or whether it's virtue signaling, and federations have said this sometimes too, about getting more players to make a living, really meaningfully putting a a hard ceiling or floor, whatever you want to call it, barrier between this top 100-ish and the rest, and having them not be able to move up quickly. Like, you know, your Luka Nardis, let's say, who just won, you know, who just beat Djokovic in Indian Wells, as we mentioned in the last episode, and it's not getting into the top 100. Like, he would be off this top tour for the whole 2024 season under this design. Who knows, he'll probably be a top 50 player this year by the year end, his current trajectory. This would sort of stop that kind of fluidity, which I think tennis is really used to players being able to rise up and have good results and to elevate themselves quickly within a couple weeks from going from challengers to top level tour success. And this would also keep players similarly who are flopping, this would keep them in draws for longer potentially. And it would also make this interesting situation where there's like maybe more clear like relegation matches happening at some point in the season, like people fighting for their cards, which would be a kind of more soccerish kind of relegation drama than we usually have in tennis explicitly. So that could be kind of interesting in a different sort of way for the sport. But yeah, but it would, in terms of what I was saying, PTPA, like income distribution, it would put a real gap between the haves and have-nots in a meaningful way. Players who are outside, who don't have their tour card, to use a sort of golf term, which is why they have, they basically get, you earn a spot for the tour that lasts you for the year. Players who don't have that would, I'm sure, have enormous drop-offs in any sponsors they have. I mean, who would sponsor a player who wasn't in the top 100? Who would give them any kind of clothing contract or any kind of deal otherwise if they're not going to be in main televised events? And then there's other questions like, would there still be qualifying for these tournaments? Probably not. I could go straight to main draws. Is that good or bad? Debatable. Would there be doubles? That's another thing. Like, I think that could be, that's certainly not mentioned in these proposals. Could doubles just be gone? Could it be restricted only to the top singles players maybe? Or is it just completely out of the sport? I mean, who knows? That doubles is a more interesting consideration about what a doubles, you know, list tour would look like, or if it was only at the Grand Slams, or what that would be. Yeah, so it would be harsher Darwinism in a lot of ways than I think a lot of the sport is sort of advocating for publicly. A lot of the players are. And so it's just be interesting to see how that would mesh when the kind of actual realities of those of this elite exclusive tour was actually implemented, how many people would be excluded and would feel like, wow, I've been kind of cut off from my dream. And we see this all the time with players who, this is gonna sound really mean and sort of sarcastic, but players who are like, oh, you know, I can't, you know, it's hard for me to make it, when they're not cutting it, when their results just don't cut it on tour. And the sort of like efforts, the most extreme example is like crowdfunding, whatever it may be, to kind of keep their careers going. This would be sort of like a, with the exception of those sort of whatever the PGA golf, it's called Q School, like the kind of place where you go to try to earn your card each year. I don't know what that would look like in tennis, but beyond that, you'd be kind of sitting on the bench, not doing much. Maybe it'd be, who knows, maybe it would be more leagues along the lines of like a World Team Tennis or French League system that would pop up, you know, year round for these players to be in kind of minor league atmospheres for tennis longer. I mean, who knows what it would be, but it would be, yeah, it's a really radical proposal, is what I'm saying. This would really, really uproot the sport, and it's kind of amazing that these four majors have signed on to this. And there's so much inertia in tennis always, and so many of the same problems that are on tour now are the same problems that are happening in 1990, you know, in terms of, you know, seasons too long, all these sorts of complaints. These are all, you know, complaints that have been around for decades, but this is a meaningful and very radical revamp. And I think people and the player side, at least that I've seen, and they're not super engaged with it, all of them, I don't think, but like, I think the sort of commentary is not really sort of sounding the oh shit alarm for how big this is a radical revamp.
Yeah. I feel like you touched on a lot of the points I had, but I mean, I agree with a lot of almost everything you said, particularly, well, for one, as you alluded to, I feel like this just quashes the, it will create a massive competitive gap. Tennis as it is now, a lot of different types of players can, it's really hard to finish a week as a champion, as it is, but at the moment, still, players, you can go and win a 500, you can be the world number 50 and win a 250, you can, and that's valuable as an athlete to be able to have that opportunity to do that. It's valuable as, you know, in order to win matches and gain rhythm and then take that to a bigger tournament and take that to bigger players. It's valuable in just a general, just almost happiness, right? In terms of just general, just having hope that you can achieve things in the sport. And it, as in these proposals, the world number, you know, the world number, there are 96 draws. The players outside of the top 30, they'll just be trying to win a couple of matches. You know, that's really all. I'm sure there'll be there would be some very few anomalies and, you know, random results, but generally it's just winning a couple of matches and understanding that this is not for you. And we see that again looking at Formula One. There's a and it's different because, I mean, it's also to do with the cars and how fast the cars are, and that's all varied and different. But there's just a massive gap between the top and the bottom, and they're all competing for completely different things and have different priorities. And so, yeah, that troubles me. And also, as you said, just I think the fluidity of the rankings is one of the magical parts of tennis, that you can be at a random challenger playing against a man and a dog and nobody, and then suddenly suddenly you're Fabian Marazan taking out Carlos Alcaraz, or as you said, Luka Nardi taking out Djokovic, and you can, and if you're good enough, you get to the top, you know, quickly, and if you're not good enough, then you're, you know, in the same breath, you fall quickly. And I think that's a great aspect of the sport. And making it even harder to get to the top, and making it even harder to have that turnover is not pleasing to me. And I think, yeah, it would completely change the sport as it is. Did you have anything to say to this? Or?
Well, I was going to say, one of your early points about the happiness quotient of the tour. I was looking at the results from this year. I mean, there's been players this year along the lines of, like, at the 500s and 250s, players like Alex Diminar, players like Bublik, players like, you know, Tommy Paul, Fritz, Sebastian Baez repeatedly, Hugo Humbert, these players who have, Dimitrov in Brisbane, these players who have earned these sorts of moments of happiness of finishing the week with a trophy and having that be like a real up. Dimitrov is a great example because he's backed it up at other big tournaments as well. They wouldn't have that. Like, you would limit the prizes so much. And maybe that hunger, I guess, maybe that increases the value. That scarcity increases the value of a Masters event. But I'm not totally sure that would be, like, immediate. Like, I don't know that starving people those other weeks increases the joy of the feast that way. I'm not sure that totally works. Maybe it does, but that's not how tennis has ever worked before. Yeah. It's kind of hard for my mind to think, like, there's no Acapulco. Therefore, people will be so desperate for Indian Wells.
No,
that doesn't immediately compute to me.
And to me, the entire point of tennis as it is now is that there are so many opportunities. There are you lose in the first round of Australian Open, French Open will be in a few months. You lose this week. You have next week to, you know, try and get better and improve and be and bounce back. And you'll see someone have a bad period, but they can turn it around. And I just don't think that will happen in a meaningful way under these rules.
And for fans too, I mean, if for fans, again, you want to watch tennis again in the month of February, obviously they would probably shift things around in the schedule and whatever this met, you know, other events would be. There'd be currently no tournaments in the month of February. There's no thousands in that event on the men's side. There's the Middle East events and where these events would be spaced. There probably would be one in theory. There'd be something put in February for sure. I'm now thinking about this, obviously, if they revamp the schedule completely. But, you know, there would be nothing as it stands now in Latin America, you know, unless a lot of fans who would have no tournaments in, you know, basically the southwest quarter of the globe. And they even like expand that upwards to the quote unquote like global south, which I think includes Mexico, like in those big tournaments there. There would be like, you know, nothing there for these people. And that's drastic. You know, no tennis to watch certain times of the year when you're free or able to do it. Nothing in your hometown, even in Washington, hell. I mean, there's plenty of people who are tennis fans in Washington who go to that tournament, I can say, every year, who don't make the trip up to the U.S. Open or to Cincinnati, but still get their fix of getting to watch top 100 level and better players in Washington for a night or two or three or four or the whole week, whatever it may be, each year. And that's their fix. And that tournament probably gets, I don't know, around 100, some low six-figure number of people through the gate every year, I'm guessing, roughly. Maybe, yeah, around 100,000. And that'd be gone. You know, that opportunity would not be there anymore. And, yeah, making it all kind of destination travel tournaments for most of the population of the world. I understand sort of the F1 appeal of that, of having all the F1 places be these really, like, sort of, like, sexy destinations, like, ooh, Monte Carlo, ooh, whatever else it may be that you're going to. But tennis has often had a more backyard appeal to it for a lot of people than that. And this is one of the arguments for keeping Davis Cup the way it used to be when they were playing, you know, more home and away ties. And certainly places like Scotland, let's say, would have a lot of Davis Cup ties that would never have hadn't had tour events. And this would be a much more extreme version of that. If there's no longer any top level tour event in the country of Germany, that's huge when there's currently so many 500, 250 events there for fans to watch. There's lots of other places, big chunks of the world I could name like that, that would be off the grid. I mean, Asia would be, East Asia would be down to one tournament, probably, we would imagine. It would be like something like Shanghai or Beijing would be the one spot of the 10 that would get the spot for the 1,000. And then nothing else in East Asia, unless they get a bid for that. And that's a huge population that currently has, I don't know, like 10 or 11 tournaments. It'd be down to one. You know, Australia wouldn't have, Australia is probably already very well served currently by population from tennis, but theirs would go down. Other parts of Europe, certainly Latin America, we mentioned, you know, yeah, it would just be this like real shrinking of the radiuses and the footprint of the tour that would wind up, I think, ill serving a lot of fans. And this is, again, what we sort of say on this podcast a lot. You know, just because someone says this is good for the business of tennis doesn't mean it's good for you, listener of this podcast, right? Like, your interests are not actually aligned with the business of the sport. It's actually not always important for you that Breakpoint, to use this example, is a breakaway success and drives interest in the sport and has lots more fans coming. Actually, you might want the demand to stay lower, so the price to stay lower for you, and you can get seats at tournaments and stuff like that. So, but this is one very clearly, yeah, where I'm just looking at all these tournaments that wouldn't be there. There's so many of tournaments that would not exist anymore in this current field. And I just really, I like Cincinnati and I like Indian Wells as places in Rome. And I recommend those tournaments to places. I don't like Madrid personally much, but I, you know, I like lots of these tournaments, but I don't think they're so good that making them slightly bigger is worth the cost of incinerating all these other great spots in the tour. Like, we're working on this during Charleston. I think Charleston is totally worth keeping. Like, why would you not keep Charleston? What kind of model says Charleston has to go? What? I don't get that. There's plenty of room in my world and my heart for Charleston. And stomach. The food there is great.
Yeah. And to, just to follow up on that, what one thing that people agree on in tennis is your face. You just... You were having a moment. You were very passionate there. Sorry.
Glad to do it. Yeah. Glad to do it.
One, sorry.
It's okay.
One thing that...
Should it be a video podcast now? I mean, who knows? Maybe we should start doing that. Everyone's doing that these days.
One thing that people in tennis seem to... The one thing that people seem to agree on is that tennis is is one of the most popular sports in the world and that it should be doing better than how it does. But the reason it's one of the most popular sports in the world is, as you've just laid out, because it's in with the exception of Africa, really, it's global. It's everywhere. And so taking that away from the sport, it doesn't compute to me either. And I think that the Lucha interview with John Wertheim, I think that was the one, what stood out to me and what stood out to other people. I'll quote him. He was explaining how tennis is inaccessible. We're arguing how inaccessible it is to fans and why this Premier Tour should happen and why it needs to change. And he mentioned that tennis is the fourth most popular sport in the world. But then he goes on to say, we dilute our own product. We compete with our own product. You might have six events in a given week. Fans struggle to know where they should be watching. Why is Sinner playing in Rotterdam and Alcaraz is somewhere in South America? That, of course, somewhere in South America, those places were Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro, two big global world cities that as we discussed, I think in the previous podcast, they receive tennis incredibly well, even though they're not watching Nadal versus Djokovic every week. And yeah, I think from my perspective, it seems like a lot of the officials in tennis, you know, the most powerful ones, particularly the slams, are interested in Anglo countries, interested in certain, so Anglo countries like the UK, Australia, US, I guess you could say Canada as well.
Yeah.
Certain countries in Western Europe. And then countries that are willing to throw, you know, crazy money at the sport. So oil-rich countries in the Middle East and, you know,
in China,
yeah, and that's all. And it's yeah. as you've explained very eloquently that it's a massive loss to the sport if those are the only parts of the world that this sport serves going forward. And yeah, I wouldn't like to see that.
Again, there's so many good, I don't know if I named all of them, but so many tournaments, you know, your Basels, your Viennas, your whatever else, Linz, like not these are all like blockbuster, you know, enormous events, but they are part of the texture of the sport. And just, again, getting rid of all of them or demoting all of them to a point where they would not be profitable. You can't make a profitable tournament with no top 100 players. There's no, you know, if Washington, for example, is demoted to being sort of on this developmental 100 through 300 level, unless you get a lot of wild cards somehow from other tour level players to participate in that tournament as well. Maybe they would. I mean, who knows? I mean, lots of Americans would want to play Washington, certainly, you know, even if they were top 50 players on the tour. Yeah, it's just a question of like, what is the cost? Again, the cost is very apparent to me, what you lose, and what you gain is less apparent to me through this. And yeah, I also just think that there's, yeah, I just don't know that it makes the sport better as a sport. Again, there's certain romances to the rising, to the falling, to qualies. I know qualies is something people in the sport debate. Is qualies worth it? I certainly think that's fair, actually. I can understand not having qualies, but also adding, but also you should, in current form, there are a way to have tennis on the weekends, which I think is a great thing. I think tennis could do little things. Like, I think Grand Slams, I've said this before, I think Grand Slams should start on the weekend, not on a Monday morning. I think that seems obvious to me as from a spectator perspective. The Saudis kind of coming in and being sponsors and slapping their PIF logo on everything and adding and sort of elbowing their way to guaranteeing a Masters event in Saudi Arabia in January or February is actually weirdly way less existential of a threat than this. That's the one that has gotten all the sort of hackles up, but the one that's sort of being cooked up by the powers that be existing in the sport, the four Grand Slams, is far more radical in a lot of ways. Yeah. And so, yeah, I just think that it's something that, again, it's tough to know because there's always so much inertia in tennis and there's been talk about changing the sport for so long. And in our careers, in our lifetimes, almost pretty much nothing's ever happened. Nothing's ever come of it. So it's tough to know how seriously to take this on some level when it just never comes to fruition. And I still see so many obstacles. But, you know, if there seems to be enough people kind of advocating for this and, you know, four of the seven kingdoms, as I call them in tennis, and the four Grand Slams are all together on this, you know, and the WTA is one of the seven kingdoms, it's not in particularly strong shape right now. And I don't know they could really put up much resistance to this.
Either way.
ATP is. I think ATP is doing well enough so they could put up a bigger fight to their possible extinction. But yeah, ATP, I think, is doing well on a lot of commercial levels. So do they deserve to be snuffed out right now? It's hard for me to say yes. Like, I just don't. I don't think they deserve that as a business, as a model. I think the ATP is a popular product. And so I don't get why they're sort of up against the wall in this way. That doesn't make sense to me on a business level. But clearly there's people who think there's more money to be made. And the other thing, this is the other thing I was going to say. This thing about tennis being so popular, this gets bandied about a bunch by certain people. PTPA brings this up to justify why they want players to get so much more money. Djokovic has said this at times, like, oh, tennis has a billion fans. It's like so popular.
Yeah.
I don't know where you come up with this number. Where you come up with this idea that it's so popular. Like, bluntly, I, for a very long time, was the most followed tennis journalist on Twitter. And I peaked like 150,000 followers. Like, there's soccer reporters or even NBA reporters or whatever other sports, like, who have comfortably 10 times what I had at my peak. You know, and this is back when Twitter was a functional, you know, popular website for sports news and such. Like, tennis just doesn't, in terms of the year-in, year-out tour, never had that. And maybe if they're saying that is, like, if they're saying it should be more like this, I haven't seen evidence of that. I just never have. You know, I don't see evidence that it's really breaking the bank. This goes to Breakpoint, which you can talk about as a sidebar if you want in here. Breakpoint failing is not not indication that tennis is a booming industry with tons of demand out there and a great product that's irresistible and should be, you know, straight bank. If Breakpoint was uniquely unsuccessful as a streaming product, it doesn't say I want to buy stock in tennis and think there's really gold in them thar hills that we need to be drilling for. frantically because it can't lose. No, I think people like the traditions of the Grand Slams. I think Wimbledon especially, and US Open probably second, have these sort of, you know, images as being, you know, world-class events, and they're kind of events, and they will be stable, and they'll be big. But, like, rising the tide to make people really give a shit about Cincinnati or Madrid or Shanghai, I don't see it happening. I don't buy that. I don't think that adds up. Those numbers don't add up to me at all, no matter what kind of, like, Facebook likes, whatever they're using to come up with this billion fans baloney.
And I do think that, yeah, baloney. And I do think that we have to accept that tennis is actually inherently very difficult to follow. And in some ways, in my opinion, these plans are making it worse. You know, going back to Formula One, I'm a fan of it and I watch it. And partly why I'm a fan and I watch it because it's so easy. There's like a race either every week or every other week. Like, you literally just have to watch one race, maybe a bit of qualifying, and that's all. With tennis, in order to, you know, to get the casual fans wanted to actually follow it, you're having to watch. There are, you know, dozens of matches every day, particularly in the earlier rounds. And it, you know, it obviously goes on, these tournaments go on for 1 or 2 weeks. It's hard enough to follow up for a whole week to be fully conscious of everything that's happening. But now they're stretching these events to 2 weeks, it's even more of a challenge. It's even more it's even more work. You're making fans work to keep in touch with the sport. And yeah, I don't see it. I don't see it.
And the elimination structure of tennis, I mean, Formula One, again, I'm not at all conversant in it really as a sport, but I know basically on that race day you have whatever Saturday or Sunday that they race on, you get all the top names in there. Lewis Hamilton will be on TV that given day. In tennis, you know, if it was just the finals, essentially, on this week we had, you know, Collins and Rybakina. And Collins is not one of the biggest stars in the sport. She's a popular story for people who are fans of the sport, but not someone who is, like, the clear protagonist of the tour. You know, before that, previous thousand couple before that, you had a Paulina Kalinskaya as your final. Like, is that something you can, if you're really reducing it, like, will you reliably have the marquee matchups to justify these results? I think no. Certainly in women's tennis right now, definitely not. And men's tennis, who knows? I mean, there can still be shakier moments of times when you get kind of like a dud match or a dud tournament or someone rolls an ankle or whatever else it may be. Like, you know, it's just, I think that the quantity, I think, is a huge insurance policy for tennis, that you will have these certain moments that, you know, certain matches are bad, but there's another one coming, and, you know, for ticket holders, that helps. Even that's, I think, one of the best arguments for doubles is that, you know, if there is some flop match, at least you get another match in the session. Doubles, I think, in terms of doubles specialists, I think there is a more sort of, I'm looking at balance sheets on the tour as an accountant for the tour or whatever person, CFO, whatever it may be. Doubles I can see really getting cut and being making business sense. But for ticket holders, just to have that kind of, again, insurance policy of having not all the eggs in few baskets, again, that can be fragile because these are humans, and you have these matches where, unlike Formula One, you know, if Lewis Hamilton, again, like, blows out a tire and is out of contention, whatever, there's still plenty of the race goes on, you know. Whereas if Sabalenka rolls an ankle, that match is over, you know. So, like, it's just a less sturdy product and a secure product in that way. And so really reducing the quantity makes the quality, because I think the quantity is the quality on a certain level in tennis as a tapestry of a tour. You never know where the best sort of matches are going to be and where things can stand out and shine. Can we talk briefly about Breakpoint in here? As sort of this, this got reported, I think, first by Stu Fraser of the Times of London during Indian Wells, that Breakpoint was not getting renewed. I had suspicions about this because they were visibly not in Australia. There were no cameras around. And so it's already like, this seems like they're not here. I asked Taylor Fritz about it, but I don't know if he knew at that point or what was going on. This was a thing that, honestly, that means not me to him. They're not going to film us all the time. But yeah, I think I speak for almost everyone in tennis that I was not impressed by Breakpoint. And I think that goes for players and media and fans alike. And there were certain people, I talked to some people, actually, I went to like high school with, and people I don't even know super well all the time who like messaged me, they were like watching Breakpoint and enjoying it. I do think it had certain kind of traction among some non-tennis fans, but not anywhere near the numbers of Drive to Survive, obviously, or even Full Swing, the golf show. I watched a bit of Full Swing. I thought Full Swing was much better. And I think there were several things that went wrong for Breakpoint. But if you want to start listing why you think this show didn't make it past season two, I'll let you start. So I don't take up all your points first. I keep doing that in this episode.
Similar thing as well. I had friends who I had kind of pushed to watch because I was curious about their reactions. And some of them liked it, sure. But I don't think it was something that they actually continued to watch on their own volition. And I don't think it was particularly interesting.
If I can say, the biggest thing about it is I don't think I ever heard about anybody using Breakpoint to watch more tennis. That's the thing that Drive to Survive did. Drive to Survive got people watching the show and they started tuning into live races and programming from the sport. I never got the sense that Breakpoint was doing anything to drive numbers to tennis, ever.
Yeah, and I mean part of that was also that they had no idea how to sell tennis. I mean, if you remember the first part of the first season, when they'd show the matches and they'd spend like half of it would be on like the first few games. You know, they'd show the games like ticking over, and they'd show the first set, and then suddenly they jump towards the end of the match or something, and it's like no one cares about the first games. show the actual dramatic moments of the match when someone's saving a match point or you know choking.
This is the other core thing that I tweeted. I had a thread about this, and several players liked this tweet actually, which is not that people who don't follow me even like I saw like Holger, who was one of the players who was profiled in season two. I know, not that I'm name dropping here really, but I think this is the point that resonated. Like the Breakpoint producers didn't seem to think on a basic level that tennis matches were interesting or dramatic. They did not seem to trust the product. They didn't seem to believe in tennis as being exciting and the ins and outs of a match and even points. They were rarely showing whole points. Like you said, they're doing this goofy thing where it's someone holds for one love in the first and then holds for one all in the first. And then it kind of skips ahead to the end of the match. And it's like, what are we even doing? This is not the rhythm of a match. They didn't seem to understand how to make tennis matches interesting, and or tennis players interesting even on a certain level. And I will say, like, and I was talking with this with other tennis players. I won't name them because they don't want to be named for this. But like when the season one came out, watching like Kyrgios, like I'm sorry, that was one of the least interesting Kyrgios portrayals you could possibly have. Like I know. And we know how to make Kyrgios interesting, or how to make him have him like say things or ask the right questions to keep him interesting. And it just didn't. That wasn't even just him. It was other players too. I think the interviewing, as far as I can tell from just seeing the answers they chose to air, was bad. I think they didn't do a good job making these players open up or having them be interesting or framing them in certain ways. Because that's something we know how to do as tennis writers that I can confidently say. I don't know about making TV shows, but I know about how to make a tennis player story interesting. How to make people care about the story of a given tennis player. And I don't think that Breakpoint reliably achieved that. And the one episode where I think they kind of did that was with Zverev, and they shouldn't have. I mean, the one where they have like this comeback from his ankle injury and that, you know, journalistic malfeasance of that, I think it's the one where they kind of pulled off the narrative, but it was completely the wrong one to do. And that was a fatal offense. I mean, it's hard to come back from that. They didn't deserve better, is what I'm saying for Breakpoint. No. Like, I just don't think that they made good choices. I put some blame, controversially not, on the players. I don't think the players gave them a ton to work with either. I don't think the players really consistently lit up for the camera and were compelling TV in a way that you kind of have to be on a reality show. I don't think a lot of them were up for that task. Some were. I think some players were good at that. You know, Ila Tomljanovic, I'll mention, is someone who had this way of just being open and frank on camera that I think she is one of the most obscure or least established stars who were featured on this show. I think that she actually did some of the best job at being, she kind of carried the second half of that first season for me. But yeah, so few players did that. And they just came off as uninteresting and inarticulate, bluntly. Yeah. And I don't think that they should be. I think tennis players are not as boring and dumb as Breakpoint made them seem. Maybe they are, but that's news to me because I usually have been able to get more out of them.
Yeah. And I'd add that I think it was over from the beginning because they somehow stumbled upon one of the biggest sporting events in history.
Djokovic deportation.
Yeah, exactly. Djokovic getting deported on the eve of the tournament, and they barely touched on it. I think they are one player.
It was like 15 seconds at the beginning of the first episode. And again, you have to, like, this is the other thing I realized after watching season one. I read an interview with the guy, one of the showrunners from the show in season one, who basically said they went to Australia with no plan.
They
knew nothing about these players. They're just kind of feeling their way through it. And they wound up doing two episodes about that 2022 Australian Open, one on Kyrgios, this is doubles run, largely.
Doubles.
And one on Berrettini-Tomljanovic. Berrettini-Tomljanovic was better, but still not great of those two episodes. The Kyrgios one I thought was really bad. And again, didn't even make Kyrgios, didn't even explain, and again, you can say problematic, like you can talk about his pleading guilty to the domestic violence thing and then getting dismissed, whatever, and all the reasons, like, and the various misogyny he's engaged with and his cozying up with Andrew Tate and all the reasons why, like, you shouldn't like this person. Fair enough. But they didn't even add any of that. And there was, like, no case made against him. They didn't show why there's actually tension around Kyrgios. They just showed him kind of being, like, oh, bad boy, but also sad. It was just, like, it was incomplete to me. If you can make Kyrgios that bland, you're not doing it right. If you choose that ingredient, it should have flavor to it. And it didn't. And it was just, for me, it was a real, real swing and a miss. It was a tennis term. You should not be missing the ball that completely as they did. Yeah, so they didn't seem to believe in it. I think there have been good tennis documentaries that have come out in the past about individual players. Certainly, like, people talk about Andy Murray resurfacing, I think was good. I think the various Serena documentaries have been pretty good a lot of times that have come out in the last 10 plus years at this point. But it's a bad one, too. The Sharapova one, I hope no one watched. It was really bad about her coming back from her suspension. That was like IMG SponCon. It was horrible. I haven't watched the Ons Jabeur one yet, actually, but I've heard that's not bad. Yeah, so, I think maybe that's the way to can be done well. So I think I chalk it up largely to incompetence of the Breakpoint people. And again, as some of the players and agents for making the product really muted. And also, I've not watched Drive to Survive, but see if you agree with this. Stu Frazier said Drive to Survive has a lot of journalists talking. Who add a lot of like the narrative and flavor. And I think for the most part, the voices they picked for tennis were really not flavorful. And we're just kind of there for like exposition and not so much there for like adding stuff. I don't know.
It just wasn't great. It was badly done. And I was actually going to mention that about them just not even knowing the terrain, not even knowing the players to speak to. I think partly, of course, also they didn't have access to the top players.
Yes.
The top players weren't interested. But also they didn't know. I remember last year I interviewed Andreescu, and she was, and I asked her about it and if she'd want to be in it. And she was like, oh, they'd asked me like at the beginning, but I wasn't ready. And now I would be. And then like they had a few weeks later, after the interview, she had cameras following her. Whereas you would have thought that they might be checking in with players more and, knowing exactly who would be kind of box office and interesting. And I should add, I don't even think Drive to Survive is good, and it suffers from like similar issues. I think a lot of fans think don't think it's for them. Like the actual fans of the sport already think. But the funny thing is that with that docuseries, it feels like they went out of their way to accentuate the drama to the point where some of it was, they'd like put things in the wrong sequence and make them more dramatic, and make it seem like Lewis Hamilton was talking trash about another driver when that wasn't really the case. Whereas it seems like in Breakpoint, they went out of their way to avoid drama at all costs. And so it ended up just being a bit boring.
It was flavorless. It was like players who are not big personalities presented in uninteresting ways. And like, again, some of it's just, and I do think part of it is the cast, like the general, like, I don't think this generation of players is naturally the ones that they picked especially are naturally the most like spicy, interesting reality TV stars. Bluntly, that's the role they were playing. Like Taylor Fritz, like, I don't think he like has that kind of like, and there's a lot, he's a lot of things going for him potentially, and has made himself, and he and his girlfriend, Morgan have done a great job making themselves sort of like getting a lot of media coverage in certain US publications at various times. But like, I don't think he actually has that kind of like dynamism on screen that really compels things. Whereas, natural, unnatural, the way that even like Tomljanovic kind of managed to do in a more low key way. I don't think Fritz has that. I don't totally know who else it would have been, but also on the casting point, this is something the golf definitely had. They had the top players. If you're making a documentary show about tennis in 2022 and 2023 and you don't have Djokovic access, what kind of show is that? He's clearly the player of this time. And he barely had Swiatek and barely had Alcaraz. Like, what are you doing? That's not a show. It was unimportant stories told badly.
Yeah, it's that part is actually fascinating to me, that golf, which is, I mean, by the metrics, is a bigger sport than tennis. Formula One, which clearly has generated a lot more attention than tennis in certain ways. That just that the stars were willing to participate, and not all of them. I think Max Verstappen didn't in Drive to Survive, but the top athletes in those sports were, whereas tennis is in a completely different almost world where the stars would opt out, and where they feel they're more separate from the product, if that makes sense. Like the access is more difficult to the top tennis players than it is to the top Formula One drivers and golf.
This is the thing with this kind of, I think this is relevant to the conversation about the viability of the sport, the Premier Tour, even the Saudi kind of level tour. Tennis is a sport that is primarily about big event, the Grand Slams. I think Grand Slams are their own brands. And then it's about stars, right? And like so often, the stars don't directly, in a way that I think is a problem for the sport, don't directly sell the tour. Yeah. Like, I'd sure put Naomi Osaka. Naomi Osaka does very little to directly promote the tournament she's playing in, almost ever. You don't see her tweeting, like, hey guys, I'm playing on Tuesday in Indian Wells. Come buy tickets, link here. Like, that doesn't happen in the sport. And why shouldn't it? Like, that's the kind of thing that should happen, you would think, in a business. If I was an organizer of a sport and was, you know, paying for the prize money and whatever accommodations for these stars, I'd expect that. I'd want them to be sort of helping and doing that part, but that's never been a part of the thing. You know, even like the tours get these sponsors, I'm picking on the women here, but like Hologic, for example, pays all this money to be WTA sponsor. You'd think that they would want to get players like Naomi, like other top stars, Iga, in Hologic ads, doing like ad reads for the brand, and like, you know, kind of flying the defending the shield or flying the banner of the tour. And you so often don't see that. They're just interested in their own separate business interests. And it's not collective in this way that maybe other sports are, or certainly leagues are, and they could be. And obviously there's some times where, you know, players are do these videos, you know, and take part in the quizzes like ATP Tennis TV does all the time, and WTA does a little bit of, or Tennis TV sometimes includes the women in them occasionally, or tournaments include the women. But, you know, like certain players just don't buy into certain parts. Like Serena, let's say, obviously for a long time did this, and she didn't even have she never did the photo shoot for the WTA that made her photo uniform with the other players on the website. She had this like small non-formatted photo because she just didn't bother to show up to a photo shoot year after year. You know, like those are kind of the challenges of dealing with these individuals who are independent contractors and aren't always made to care about the bottom line of the sport in certain ways. Obviously Serena, because I named her, did other things to promote the sport, but not everything that sort of being a general company employee woman would sort of, you know, anticipate from her there. So those are challenges for the sport as well. And like, yes, like is Naomi a bigger deal than to use her example again, than the Rouen tournament she's playing? Yes, very much so. She's a bigger name, and I think she does with bigger news than anything normal that would happen in Rouen. And so that's sort of another balance that the sport has. And again, if they're sort of restricting the number of players, how many exemptions would they give for stars? Like, you know, like, would you give spots on the tour to an Osaka who is not in the current top 100, but, you know, is clearly a top 100 draw? Or players even like Berrettini, who's coming back and is not a top 100 player, I don't think, currently, but who's clearly kind of has that kind of star power. They're like, what kind of fudgings do you do to those sorts of things and exemptions and wild cards? I think they have that for the tour too. And there are, golf, I think they do have some, I don't know the total rules for how you get your tour card, but there are ways you get kind of grandfathered in to have kind of, if they're not lifetime memberships, I don't know what they are exactly, but certain ways you can stay around that I imagine someone like an Osaka would qualify for on paper with four Grand Slams and former number one to her name. But Berrettini, I don't know, maybe not. I mean, yeah. It's kind of a trickier thing. So lots of things to figure out and lots of disruption happening. And if and when this becomes official, we can dive into it even more and talk to people even more about what it's going to do to the sport and ramifications. Waiting for, we kind of gave the Saudi part of this not very full shrift in this. We talked about them before, but yeah. The sort of Saudi proposal, which is less radical. And it's really, that's really just them sponsoring and adding a Masters event. That's not like seismically disruptive to the, you know, architecture of the sport in the way that this Premier Tour proposal from the Slams would be. It would make the sport pretty unrecognizable in a lot of ways. And I don't think the money would have to be so big for players to like it more, I feel like, that I don't know that it could be. And there are certain things, right? There are certain things, and a lot of this goes to just, this is, a lot of this is actually just cover for what could be a less radical fix, but still monumental, which would be just merging the powers that be. The most important part of this, maybe we didn't talk about enough in this conversation, is that the idea of having the Slams and the men's women's tours all under one umbrella. That's the biggest thing the Premier Tour would be. You know, it's not having them competing for interests. And would they all get along in the same office building? I don't know. I don't know how that would work. I don't know who gets put in charge. You know, who becomes commissioner of tennis at that point?
Yeah.
Those are great questions. And that kind of decision would do a lot to determine how successful or how, or who would feel that they won or lost in this transition. So, yeah, it's interesting. We'll keep apprised of it. But I do think it is a, when you look at, when you hear this sort of, yeah, the way that this USTA CEO talked to John Wertheim about it, it's worth, I'll link to it in the description of this episode, this interview. Yeah, it's hard to sort of overstate how dramatic the changes would be to the running of the sport. It just would be totally, totally different. Would it be better or worse? TBD, but yeah. It would be hugely different.
And I think what both of us are very skeptical about whether it will be better, to be frank.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying it can't be better, but I know, I can sense immediately what the losers would be. I can tell pretty quickly some of the things, at least, it would be lost. And I can't say for sure many things that would be gained right away. I do think some certain things, like if you get all the broadcast deals united together, because God knows in the US you have to have so many different packages to watch tennis, you know, even just across whatever, three or four channels it is and stuff like that. If that would all be united, that'd be good. Prize money being equal.
Equal prize money, yeah.
Equal prize money is great if that happens.
Shorter season, no, yeah.
Yeah, shorter season, I think it's fine, yeah.
There are certain pluses, but I'm not sure about whether the essence of tennis as it is now would remain under those circumstances. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. And with that, thank you guys for listening to the show. We'll be back with you in due time. I don't have a great sense of the timeline of this decision, really.
I think the meetings are happening at a lot of the Masters 1000s. And
I think Madrid is the next one, right?
Madrid,
we should be okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Bye, folks.
Bye-bye.
Actually, no. The next episode we'll do, it's on Challengers, the movie. That'll come out next. Bye, folks.